There is, in 1947, there was several ships around the area of the Solomon Islands heard an SOS from a ship called the Urang Madan. And the message said that all of the officers and most everyone on board the ship was dead. And it became apparent that the person sending the message joined all of his shipmates pretty quickly because there came a transmission that had some garbled text and ended with the words, "I die." And then there were no more transmissions. A couple of ships that were in the area were able to track down the coordinates that had been transmitted and found the vessel. And sure enough, everyone on board the ship was dead. And no one has ever been able to figure out what happened on those ships and how on that ship and how those people died. It's a mystery to this day. There are a lot of mysteries in this world. Article in the newspaper yesterday said that the trailing edge of the port wing of an airliner that has been washed up on the shore of an island in the Indian Ocean has been identified as coming from the Malaysian Air plane that went down in the Indian Ocean a couple of years ago and has never been, no one's ever been able to figure out what happened to that aircraft. We still don't know. There are other mysteries that are out there that are kind of strange. Did you know that since 2007, 16 severed feet in athletic shoes have washed up on the shores of British Columbia and Washington? No one knows where they're coming from. Very bizarre. Want to go to the beach? There are a lot less grisly conundrums in the world, like puzzles like, why is abbreviated such a long word? You know? And who thought it was a good idea to put the letter S in the word lisp? You know? If money doesn't grow on trees, why do banks have branches? Or this one, why do you get a penny for your thoughts, but put your 2 cents worth in? Today, as we continue our study of the book of David, the life of David, we're going to look at an incident that's kind of puzzling. In fact, it's downright disturbing for most of us today. It's an uncomfortable puzzle. And yet this rather bizarre incident has a very important message for all of us, because all of us are going to face mysteries in our personal lives that are difficult. You know, why does life sometimes just seem perverse? Why does it go the way it does? Why doesn't it go better for us than we wish it would? Why is there so much pain in this world? I don't have answers for all those questions, but this incident actually has a message that will help us, there's truth here that will help us understand how we can think about life and at least how we think about some of those questions. So we're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 through 11, the life of David. Here's what happens. David, again, brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000. He and all his men went to Baalah in Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the Ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Okay, the first thing and the main thing that happens in this passage is that David tried to move the Ark to the city of Jerusalem, where David had just established his capital. Now, I can hardly believe it's been 35 years since the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark burst on the scene. When I first thought, man, I thought, what a great movie. And I still think it's one of my favorites. You remember Harrison Ford plays adventurer and archaeologist Indiana Jones. I actually still have an Indiana Jones hat. And I was going to wear my Indiana Jones hat and leather jacket this morning, but it's just too warm outside, so I passed on that. In it, Indiana is the main character, but the subject of the movie is the famous Ark of the Covenant of the Hebrew religion. The point, of course, in the story was to keep it out of the hands of the Nazis who wanted to use it for their nefarious purposes. When God instituted the covenant between him and the Jewish people through Moses at Mount Sinai, he gave them a lot of rules to obey, the all Ten Commandments and all of the law there, but also he gave them a number of rituals and ceremonies and some instruction about some ceremonial objects, sacred objects, chief among them being the Ark of the Covenant. Now, our word Ark is actually derived from the Latin word arca, which meant box. And that Latin word was used because the Hebrew word that's translated Ark that literally meant box. So it can demystify it a little bit if we just realize that what it really is the box of the covenant. It was a box, almost 4 feet long, almost 2.5 feet wide, 2.5 feet wide, overlaid with gold. I think we have a picture of it. There it is. That's pretty much what it looked like. Had two angels on each end with their wings extended over the box. Each year on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, which is coming up, the chief priest would make sacrifice for the sins of the people. And the blood of the sacrifice would be sprinkled on the cover of the ark, symbolizing that sacrifice was accepted because the ark represented the presence of God with his people. And that sacrificial blood poured there represented God, where in his presence was where sins are judged and forgiven, and represented their sins being forgiven by God. Now, the ark really was lost. When the Babylonians destroyed the city of Jerusalem in 587 BC, the ark pretty much disappeared from history. There are literally 20 different theories about what happened to it. One of them was the one represented in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, that ended up down in Egypt. There was one that ended up down in Ethiopia. There's another that it was actually, it's still under the city of Jerusalem, buried in a vault. But the truth is, we don't know what happened, but most likely what happened is that it was destroyed, that the Babylonians probably captured it and destroyed it. Now, the ark contained the original Ten Commandments, the stone tablets from Mount Sinai, and it contained a jar of manna that, you know, God provided for the people of Israel when they were in the wilderness. And so you would think this, representing the very presence of God, would have been, you know, something you would treasure and protect carefully. You know, a few years ago, well, not a few years ago, more than 20 years ago now. Wow, we're getting old. Anyway, our family went on a trip to Washington, D.C., and while we were there, we visited the National Archives. And we stood in line for quite a while to go and get just a few seconds to look at the Declaration of Independence, which is under, you know, in this thick plexiglass box. You know, our society, we're not very good at reverence, but Americans have reverence for the Declaration of Independence. And there's kind of an almost holy moment when you can actually look at that document. We treasure that thing and we take care of it, guard it carefully. You would think Israel would do the same thing with the Ark of the Covenant. And they sort of did, but not very well. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, there's an incident where they're having at war, as usual, with the Philistines, and they've been defeated in battle. And so somebody comes up with a brilliant idea. You know, it's the good idea fairy shows up. And in verse 3, they say this, "Let us bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies." So we got beaten in our last battle. The next battle, let's take the ark into battle with us, and that'll be God will go with us and he'll defeat the enemy. Yeah, you know, when the Americans were, you know, landing on Omaha Beach, they didn't bring the Declaration of Independence along, you know? You protect that thing. Not Israel. They took it into battle and they suffered a worse defeat than the first one. 30,000 of them were killed and the Philistines captured the ark. They were thrilled. We got the Israelis' holy object, you know. The ultimate win in the capture the flag game. But pretty quickly, the Philistines who had captured people around it started getting sick. Some of them started dying, and they quickly figured out, we don't want this thing anymore. It's killing us. So they put it on a cart. They sent it off in the direction of the Israeli border. And so it came back to Israel. When it got to a place called Beth Shemosh, some of those people said, hey, it's the ark, it's back. Hey, I wonder what's inside this thing. So they, concerned about it might be booby-trapped, they called their ordnance disposal people. No, they didn't. They looked inside. 70 of them died. Well, the result of that was they said, this thing is dangerous to have around. So they sent it to the house of a guy named Abinadab, who lived in a place called Kiriath Yearim, which actually translated kind of means forest town, which suggests it was sort of a rural, woodsy place. And so what essentially happened was they said, let's send it out there where it's not going to bother anybody. And it stayed there for 20 years. Now, this is the most holy object in all of Israel. And they've got it out, you know, I mean, would we, they lost track of it. They forgot about it. It's off out there somewhere. It would be like us, you know, sending the Declaration of Independence to Chunky, Mississippi and losing track of it out there, or maybe Bakersfield, you know. Where did that thing go? I don't know. It's lost somewhere. Well, David has now said, I'm establishing this new capital, and David is concerned with uniting all of Israel, and he realizes one of the ways he can do that is by focusing all their spiritual attention on the capital. He wants to make it a worship center as well as a political center, and the way he can do that is by bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. So he gathers 30,000 troops to make a huge parade to celebrate the coming of the ark to Jerusalem. Now, in the story, in this process of bringing the ark, David experienced the power of the ark. Verses 3 through 5 says, "They set the ark of God on a new cart, brought it from the house of Abinadab, which is on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio are guiding the new cart." And then we have, you know, everything's going fine. Everybody's celebrating. It's a great day. Verses 6 and 7 tell the strange story. "When they came to the threshing floor at Nakon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act, and therefore God struck him down, and he died." Excuse me? He died because he simply tried to steady the ark, keep it from falling off the cart? Hey, you know, that's a little bit more, how do we understand that? It's, you know, those are the kinds of things you hope that skeptics never read. It's like, oh, this is the God you want to worship, that he kills a guy because he tried to keep the ark from falling off a wagon? Really? You know, people try to come up with natural explanations. You know, maybe there was something about the ark that was virulently radioactive. You know, it kind of sounds like it's radioactive. There's, you know, the people of the Philistines started getting tumors. Literally, it says, and dying sounds like maybe radiation could have caused a problem. The people of Beth Shemesh, they looked in there and they died. Maybe they were exposed to radiation. And now Uzzah gets to, it suffered from radiation. Maybe that's the problem. You know, I don't know if you know this. Did you know that bananas are radioactive? I was surprised to discover that actually a bunch of 10 bananas gives off as much radiation as a handful of uranium. Did you know that? I didn't know that. As I was reading about this, I did a little research and found out that the Defense Department actually at one time tried to create a banana bomb, but but they didn't find the project appealing. Enough of the monkey business. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. No, bananas really are radioactive, so maybe there was a bunch of bananas in there. No, there wasn't bananas in there. There's obviously a problem with the idea that it was radioactive. And one of the big problems with that is that at the end of the story, the ark goes to the house of Obed-Edom, and his whole family gets blessed. You don't get blessed by radioactivity. And furthermore, it's very clear that the passage says God acted to strike this guy down. Poor David, he, in verses 9 and 10 say, he's afraid of the Lord that day. He said, how can the ark of the Lord ever come? How can we ever have this thing in Jerusalem? It's going to kill people. What do we do? And so they send the ark off to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Gittites, as I'm sure you know, were famous nuclear engineers. No. Obed-Edom, what did he do that you're going to give him this radioactive thing, you know? Nothing. They just warned him, just don't touch it. Leave it out there. Just leave it alone. But this amazing thing happened. After a few months, they discover that, we don't know exactly how, but his family was blessed. You know, I assume they were having lots of crops and other good things happening, and they began saying, hey, you know, maybe that thing isn't dangerous. Maybe it's a good thing. The point is, this thing, this holy object, appears to be exerting some kind of force that can be so powerful as to actually cause people to die. On the other hand, so powerful to cause great things, good things, blessings to happen to people. David sees both of these happen. Now, the result of that is, we're going to see next week, he decides he finally can bring the box to Jerusalem. Now, we don't really have a good explanation at this point for the shocking demise of Uzzah. You know, some people will say, oh, well, he probably just had a heart attack, you know, and the superstitious writer said, oh, it was God who did it. But that doesn't explain what happened to the 70 people at Beth Shemesh. It doesn't explain what happened to the Philistines, and it doesn't explain what happened to Obed-Edom. You either have to look at this and say, you know what, this is superstition, this is legend, or you have to say, this is telling us something that we need to understand, and it's actually true, which the Bible claims to be. One of the things we need to understand is the ark was not a magically powerful object. The premise of the movie, The Raiders of the Lost Ark, was that the Nazis believed that the ark exerted mystical power, and they thought power resided in the box itself and could be wielded by the possessor of the box for their own purposes, whatever they may be. That is not, in fact, accurate. Was not the box that wielded power. The box represented something. It was a picture of something. And what it was a picture of is the presence of God. And it is God who wields the power, not the box. We need to understand that gold-plated box on its own was nothing more than a fancy box. That's all. It is God who is at work here, and it is his power that is being displayed. And David understood that. Well, that's what happens, but now we need to think about, yeah, so what does this have to do with us? What are the implications for us? You know, is this some weird, superstitious fairy tale? The Bible says, no, this actually happened, and it actually represented the power of God at work, and it says something to us today. And the first thing it says is that God is, in fact, powerful. Now, David knew that in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 45, when he faced off against Goliath. David said, you come against me, Goliath, with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel. In other words, you're toast, because I've got God's power working, and it's way better than anything you've got. In Psalm 62, verses 11 and 12, David wrote, one thing God has spoken, two things I have heard. Power belongs to you, God, and with you, Lord, is unfailing love. David said, I've heard and I understand two things about God. Number one, all power belongs to you, Lord. And number two, with you is unfailing love. You never stop loving. Those are two really, really important statements. What an interesting way to put that. Power belongs to you, Lord. He owns it. Every bit of power that exists belongs to God. You know, I have a Honda Accord sitting outside. Belongs to me. If you want to use it, you have to ask if I will allow you to. I can say, no, you can drive it, or yeah, you can borrow it, you can do whatever you want with it, but it's my choice. Every bit of power that is exerted in all of creation belongs to God and is only allowed to exist by His permission. How great is God's power? Ephesians 3:20 says, now to Him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. Now that's pretty amazing. He says, God is so powerful that He is able to do more than we can ask. The wildest thing you can imagine asking, God can do more than. In fact, He says, God can do more than you can even imagine, more than you can even think of. God has more power than that. Well, no, wait, you know what's even bigger than that? God has immeasurably more power than anything you can even imagine. So if you think of the wildest, most powerful thing you could ever ask or imagine asking, the gap between God's true power and what you have imagined is so immense you can't even measure it. That's how vast God's power is. And we understand that when we look around at the universe and we see its vastness and the incredible forces at work there, and we think, yeah, all of that belongs to God. It's enormous. Back in July, Lori and I went to visit Carissa and Michael, our daughter and son-in-law, back in Mississippi. And we went in July because it's so beautiful there that time of year. No. We went because ever since they moved there 3 years ago, they have said every summer, we want you guys to come and go to the Pensacola Air Show with us. And so the previous two summers, we said, okay, we're going to do that, and then something has come up, once for us and once for them. We weren't able to do it. So this summer, we said, we're doing that. We're going. So July, we went down to the Pensacola Air Show, which is a really cool environment because you get to watch the Blue Angels while you're sitting on the beach. Then they're flying right there in front of you, right over the water. So cool. And this year, Michael, our son-in-law, had actually two of his friends were in the Blue Angels, so that made it even more cool. So we're there watching the Blue Angels, and most of you have seen the Blue Angels, so you know how they do this, but it always surprises me. They have one thing that I have seen their show before, and I always forget, and when it happens, it's like, it's so cool. And it's for the four-ship formation. They're doing this maneuver, and it's really a cool maneuver, and you're watching them. They're like, oh, that's so cool. And then they fly up, and they fly over behind you. They're flying out this way. And while your attention is looking up over here, all of a sudden, one of the solo jets comes blasting in at low level. I mean, this thing, we're sitting about 100 yards from the pier. It looked like it cleared the pier by about 10 feet. And it comes in full afterburner. So it's like, oh, look at this. And all of a sudden, this thing comes flying by in full afterburner, and the sound of that jet is incredible. You feel it as much as you hear it. It just is thundering along. It's just the whole crowd just goes, oh man, so cool. I love that power. You just feel it right down in your bones. You know that power of those two jet engines on that F-18 is nothing compared to the power of God. It's power so immense it just blows us away. David understood that, but you know, the problem for human beings is we forget, don't we? You know, you look back at the history of Israel and they were in slavery in Egypt, and God does all these miracles to get them out. Yay, we're free, and they're heading out, and they get to the Red Sea, and the Egyptians are coming, and what happens? We're going to die. There's no hope. God that just did all these amazing things. What the heck? And then they cross the Red Sea, you know, waters part, and they go into the desert, and they get out there a couple of days, and they run out of water. We're going to die. God brought us out here in the desert to kill us. You know, come on. It's human nature. The kings of Israel, they heard all about and knew all about God's power. But time and time again, they would get threatened. And even though God said, trust in my power, they'd start looking for, oh, who can we get as an ally to help us protect us from an enemy? When God said, don't ever do that. They forgot. The disciples of Jesus walked around and saw him do incredible miracles. He's healing people. He's making water turn into wine. He's feeding thousands of people. And then they're in the boat crossing the lake, and the squall comes up. And what happens? We're going to die. We're going down. Remember the guy in the back of the boat and his power? Oh, yeah, that guy. Oh, yeah, that power. Okay. We all have that problem, don't we? Yeah, God's power. I believe it. Oh, we're going to die. We forget. So God, understanding that, said, David, I'm going to give you a demonstration of power that you will never forget to remind you where the power comes from and who it belongs to. Our problem is that somewhere inside our heads, we have this intellectual thing that says, yep, God's powerful, but we have a disconnection between that and how we actually live. Because, you know, we don't see God doing miracles and zapping people, and we tend to sort of give assent to God's power, but live as though it's not real. And part of the problem is that we want God to use his power to work miracles to make our lives go the way we want. And when he doesn't, we get kind of disappointed in him, and we sort of say, forget his power. Here's what I think we should take from this. God is powerful, and it is his power. The message here is it's his power, and in living in his presence that guarantees blessing. That's what Obed-Edom found out. That's what David observed. Oh, living in the presence of God, the way he wants us to live, is what produces blessing. But we have to be careful how we define blessing. You know, in the Old Testament, one of the things we continually forget is that the Old Testament uses physical pictures to represent spiritual truth to us, to teach us about spiritual truth. So we see a lot of things in the Old Testament about abundance and plenty and wealth and all of that, and we think, well, yeah, that's what I want. But those are intended as pictures for us today of spiritual truth, of spiritual abundance and health and plenty. That's what it's about. So living in the presence of God brings not necessarily good circumstances, but the life that we long for, which is a life of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness. Isn't that what we want? You know, one of my dreams that will never be fulfilled is that I would be a successful novelist. And I've written several books, and I've, wouldn't it be cool if I, one of those ended up on the you know, top 10 bestseller list? Wow, that God, that would be great. You know, why don't you make that happen, Lord? And you know what? I actually do have two books on the Amazon top seller list. Currently, my bestseller is at 1,801,257. So we got a ways to go, you know. but here's the thing. Maybe you've heard of the writer Pat Conroy. You know who he is? Best-selling author. He's written Prince of Tides, Great Santini. Bestsellers, made into movies, written a number of others. In his book, My Losing Season, his autobiographical book, he said that every time he wrote a book, he ended up in a mental hospital. The poor man just died earlier this year, had no peace whatsoever. He had bestsellers all over the map. Terrific writer. I mean, the guy was an amazing writer, but his soul was tortured. Is that really what we long for? If you had a choice between being a tortured soul who had bestsellers and having no bestsellers, but having a life of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, which would you choose? I hope you would choose the latter. I sure would. And so what we need to remember is God's power going to work to produce blessing in our lives? Yes, it does. The blessing we really want. We only think we want these things like fame and success and money and health because we think those will give us a life of love, joy, peace, patience, and all of the rest. That's what we want. And God's power works to produce that when we live in His presence. So that's the first thing we need to understand. But the second thing we need to understand is maybe the harder part of this, and that is that God is holy. The movie Raiders of the Lost Ark is all about what tends to drive us when it comes to God. The Nazis in the movie wanted one thing. They wanted power to be able to wield against their enemies and to control all of the world. And so they sought the ark thinking it would give them that power. Israel kind of wanted the same thing. Do you remember the story I told of we lost a battle to the Philistines? Let's take the ark into battle with us because we want to use its power to defeat our enemy. David, at this point in his life, was faced with a temptation. And the temptation was, I want to unite all of Israel. How can I do that? I can use the ark to bring about my goal. Here's the problem. All of those things, they were saying, we have a goal. We want power. We want victory. We want unity. And I will use God to get it. That's what people were trying to do. That's what the Nazis were trying to do in the movie. And the message here is, you can't do that because God is holy. Yeah, how do you get to that from the incident with Uzzah? Well, God had given instructions about the ark. When you move it, there is a specific way to do it. There was a group of, a clan of Levites, special priestly group, the Kohathites. They were the only ones who were supposed to move that box. And they were to do it by sticking poles through the rings on each corner of it. And that's how you were to move it. Israel didn't do any of that. In fact, in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, before attempting to move the ark again, David called leading priests to him in verse 11 and verses 12 and 13. He said, you are the heads of the Levitical families. You and your fellow Levites are to consecrate yourselves and bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place I have prepared for it. It was because you, the Levites, did not bring it up the first time that the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. We did not inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way. we're just going to, hey, well, let's move the ark. Yeah, that's good. We'll do it however we want. You know, how do we do things in our day? Oh, we move things on a cart. Well, let's get a new cart. This will be great. God will be honored. You know, here's the problem. Uzzah wasn't a Kohathite. You don't move the ark on a cart. And most of all, whatever you do, you never touch the ark. In Numbers chapter 4, verse 15, it says, after Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, when the camp is ready to move, these are instructions about how do we move the holy things, including the ark. You cover them all. And only then are the Kohathites to come and do the carrying, but they must not touch the holy things or they will die. God said, look, this represents the presence of God. You regard it as holy and you do not touch it. And Uzzah and everybody else said, let's just move the thing. Oh, it's falling. God said, you did not listen. You did not obey. You just did whatever you thought was the most expedient. Here's the problem. God is holy, meaning he is absolutely pure. He cannot tolerate anything that is not absolute good. And that's good because if he tolerated anything other than good, then he's accepting evil. And evil, by definition, is evil. It does damage. It is destructive. And so God says, I will not allow evil, even the tiniest bit of evil creates enormous harm. You know, if you had a choice between a little bit of Ebola virus or a little bit of cancer on the one hand and a little bit of evil on the other, take the virus or the cancer. It's less destructive than evil. Evil is saying to God, I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to do it my way. It is that decision that is the source of all of the destruction, all of the pain, all of the suffering that exists in all of creation. And God says, it must not happen. And so God says, you are to approach me with reverence and you are to approach me as holy and to regard what I say as holy and true. And you need to understand when you fail to do that, you are introducing death and destruction into the environment. And I'm going to give you a picture of it right now. When Uzzah doesn't pay attention to what I've said, and he dies. Now, we might think, well, now, okay, this is all about respecting, having reverence for God's holiness, but how is that fair to Uzzah? Well, you need to remember this. God warned Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. He said, okay, you can do anything you want, eat of anything. There's just this one tree. Don't eat of that tree's fruit. And the day you disobey me, the day you do that, you will die. Now, they disobeyed. And a lot of people will say, well, and they died spiritually that day. And they did. But God didn't just mean they would die spiritually. He did mean that. But he also meant they would literally die physically for disobeying him. And ultimately, they did die physically, and it was a result of their choice to disobey God. But here's what we need to understand. Every day that they lived physically on this earth, between the day they ate of that fruit and the day that they died, every single day was nothing but God's grace given to them, because what they deserved was death. They had chosen it. And the same is true for every single one of us. The day that we choose to go our way and not God's, from that moment on, every day we live is nothing but God's grace. And every one of us has chosen that when we were 2 years old or less. We have been living on nothing but grace ever since.
And so had Uzzah.
So when we look at this, we say, oh, well, that's not fair to Uzzah. Uzzah got what was just. He just got it a little sooner than maybe you thought he would. Every day prior to that had been nothing but grace. That day he got justice. You know what? After that shocking incident, everyone, beginning with David, understood that God is holy and he is not to be approached casually. He's not to be trifled with. He's not to be used for our selfish purposes. Scholar Walter Brueggemann, in his commentary on 1 and 2 Samuel, wrote, "When people are no longer awed, respectful, and fearful of God's holiness, the community is put at risk because we are choosing evil." So, how do we respond to this lesson? Well, okay, here's several things. First, we must refuse to try to use God for our purposes. It's what the Nazis wanted to do. It's what Israel wanted to do. It's what David might have been tempted to do and God warned against. That's not respecting what's holy. When we say, well, I want to use God to get what I want. You might say, well, you know, I don't do that. Actually, it happens a lot in our culture. The health and wealth gospel is all about that. What's the goal? I want to be healthy. I want to have a lot of money. I want to be successful. What do I have to do to manipulate God into giving it to me? That's about using God to get something I want. That's not regarding God as holy. Oh, yeah, but we're not health and wealth gospel people. Yeah, no, we're not. But we have a subtle way we do the same thing. When things don't go the way we want, how do we respond? God doesn't answer our prayer the way we want. We start to get a little resentful of him. Why haven't you answered him? Why aren't you giving me? What are we saying? Well, I have this thing that I want, and I want to use God to get it. And if he doesn't give it to me, I'm going to be mad. That is not regarding God as holy. You know, our little granddaughter, Ella, is one of the, she is maybe the happiest child I have ever encountered as a baby. She smiles all the time. You get this huge grin. She's just a delight to be around. But she does have her moments. And not too long ago, Anna texted us a picture. It was just heartbreaking. I got this picture. There she is. That's so sad, you know. And just crying. She's got the tears coming down. And, you know, she texted us this picture. We said, oh, what happened? Well, here's what happened. Ella had taken a dog treat out of the mouth of Banjo, their dog. Just, he had this dog treat, and she took it away from him. And Anna came over, and she said, no, that's Banjo's. And she took the dog treat away from Ella and gave it back to Banjo. And this was the reaction. How could you? You've taken my used dog treat away from me. How can I ever live? In that moment, Ella was not regarding her mother as holy. She was not saying, I respect my mother and her wisdom and her goodness that she's looking out for my best. I want my dog treat. And that's all I care about. And when we don't get what we think we want from God, and we start pulling this face, we're not respecting God as holy. So let's not try to use God as holy as a tool to get what we want. Second thing is we must regard obeying God as a matter of utmost urgency if we're going to regard God as holy. You know, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, if I'm Uzzah, and if it was in that situation, I was paying attention, I think I would have said, you know, the most important thing to me here is that we understand how God wants us to do this. And I don't care if the way we do things in our culture is we put the ark on a cart. That's not what God says. I'm going to do what God says. That's regarding God as holy. That's what we should do as well. That was part of the message. You want to obey God if you regard him as holy. You know, for Ella, in that sense, regarding mommy as holy is saying to her, mommy, if you want to take the dog treat away from me and give it back to Banjo, I'm okay with that. And I will never have another dog treat if you don't want me to have a dog treat. I will do whatever you want. That's regarding mommy as holy. So we obey God. And then finally, we live in awe of God and his holiness. You know, have you ever wondered about why do people, you know, get off and we're going camping, they get around the campfire and they tell spooky stories, right? Who's got my golden arm? You know that story? Yeah. Why do people tell spooky stories around the campfire? Why do we do that? Why do people get fascinated by stories of ghost ships like the Urang Madan? Why are we so obsessed with things like the Bermuda Triangle? It's because there's something that draws us to that tingly feeling of, ooh, there's something spooky out there. Theologians call it the mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery. There's a power out there and we sense it. And we're scared by it, but drawn to it. And we love that feeling of having a little touch of that awesome mystery. Do you know what that's about? It's about the holiness of God. We were created to live in awe of God's holiness and to have that spine-tingling sense of his presence. We don't live much with reverence in our culture. We're not good at reverence. We almost don't even understand what it is. But we're still drawn to it because we were created for it. We went to Safari Park, San Diego Safari Park, the park formerly known as the Wild Animal Park, last December. And it was kind of cold. It was a little bit disappointing because most of the animals were kind of sheltering and shivering, just trying to stay warm, you know. I'm pretty lethargic. But there was one place that was kind of cool, and it was the lion enclosure. And they have this place where you get up really close to lions because they have this big, thick plexiglass barrier. There was a lion that was lying right up against that. And it was interesting that people wanted to come up and just get right next to that thing and even put their hand up there next to it. It was so cool because here is this enormous beast that is just big and scary. I mean, it just is so large and so powerful and so impressive that we're drawn to that. And really glad that plexiglass is in the way. Nobody's fighting to climb over that thing to get into that enclosure to go shake hands with the lion. Because it's really cool, it's really attractive, but you know, let's just recognize that we don't get too close, you know? It's a little bit like our God. You know, when Isaiah stood before him and the cherubim were shouting, holy, holy, holy. Old Isaiah went, oh no, I'm a dead man. I shouldn't even exist in the presence of such holiness. And he ends up saying, I'm a man of unclean lips. In other words, everything that comes out of me is tainted. And I realize it now that this holiness is just frightening and scary to me. But do you remember what happened? The Lord sent an angel that put a burning coal on his lips. Do you know what that symbolized? I'm cauterizing your unholiness. I'm forgiving you and going to make you clean in my presence. Here's the great news for us. In the presence of the almighty, powerful, holy God, who is potentially an enormous threat to our very existence because we are not holy. And he cannot abide evil. Somehow, through the cross of Jesus Christ, he has cauterized our unholiness so that we are able to stand in his presence. And he even says, now I want you to draw near to me. Not just get up on the other side of the plexiglass close to the great animal, but to climb right in and be in his presence. This passage calls on us to live in awe of an almighty, holy God with great reverence, understanding his grace, his power, his goodness, and longing to be in his presence and to give him the praise that he is so worthy of. Let's live with awe and reverence at his majestic holiness. Let's pray. Father, story is one that makes us uncomfortable, and that's probably a good thing. It makes us realize that you are holy, and you see all of creation and all of life very differently than we do. You see it correctly, and we do not. You are holy, and we are not. And so this story reminds us of your great power. Power even to bless as we live in your presence and experience your holiness and your grace and your goodness to us. We experience the blessing that we really want, not the one we think we want. The blessing of a life of holiness, a life of love and joy and peace. And so, Father, we pray this morning that you will cause us to be more and more aware of your holiness, to bow before you and to live our entire lives in awe of you and your holiness. We praise you today, God, as our holy Lord, the Almighty God, the God of grace. Amen.